A city dark except for golden flickering windows watching over the night. Peace settling in, meals being prepared, chimneys billowing. But then, the peace was disturbed. Sounds crawled up my spine. Sounds that weren't from the world outside my window. The crunch of stone, the hiss of steam, a keening howl. Fervor, Jezalia, fervor. My heart sped. I felt the Komazar's breath on my neck, his finger tracing the kava on my shoulder. I saw his onyx eyes in the darkness, and the smile behind them. "Shall I walk with you?" I jumped and whirled. Aunt Cloris poked her head into my chamber, her question a reminder not to be late. I smiled, trying to mask my alarm. While my aunt had tolerated the complete lack of protocol on every level with surprising grace, I saw the signs of her impatience returning. She wanted things to go back to the way they were before. I couldn't promise that, but I could give her tonight. "I'll be along," I said. She left as quietly as she came, and I shut the window, returning to my dressing table. With only one hand, there would be no fancy braids tonight. Not that I was ever particularly skilled at braids, even with two hands. But I had become skilled at using a sword and knife with either one. When the physician checked and rebandaged my hand today, I got a good look at it for the first time. The wound itself, except for the three small stitches on either side, was barely visible, but my hand was still swollen. It looked like a blue-veined glove stuffed with fat sausages, and felt just as foreign and numb. Something inside had cracked or torn, probably when I shoved the bolt loose to kill Malik. The physician was dismayed by the continued swelling, and said it was essential that I keep it elevated on pillows at night, and he crafted a sling for me to wear by day. When I asked about the numbness, he only said, "We'll see." I set aside my brush and looked in my mirror. My hair trailed loosely over my shoulders. On the outside, I mostly looked as I had before, perhaps a little gaunt. But on the inside, nothing was the same. It would never be the same again. "He's betrothed." The thought came unexpectedly, like a sudden gust of wind. A mountain of demands had blocked it out, but now a single unhurried moment had let it back in. I jumped up from my dressing table, adjusting my belt, my sling, sheathing my knife at my side, learning to do with one hand what I had always done with two. The family dining chamber was for smaller, more intimate meals, but tonight there would be 16 of us. I would have just sipped some broth in my room and fallen into bed, as I had previous nights, or eaten through our late-night meetings, but my mother had come to me herself and suggested it, and she hadn't left her room in days. I thought about my doubt in the days after Aster had died, and how Rafe had told me I needed to regroup and move forward. It seemed like that was what she was trying to do now. My aunts chimed in, saying that in the frenzy of activity over the last few days, they'd met everyone only in frantic passing moments. They said we had a long fight ahead of us, and a shared meal would give us a chance to knit tighter together. I couldn't argue with that. Birdie and I were the first to arrive in the dining room, and when she hugged me, I got a warm whiff of fresh bread and saw a dusting of flour on her cheek. "Have you been in the kitchen?" She winked. "I may have stopped in. Your mother asked, and I was happy to oblige." I was about to ask her what she had been doing there when Gwyneth and Natia walked in behind us. Natia's gaze immediately rose to the high ceiling, and then she surveyed the tapestry-covered walls. I remembered the first time I had ever dined with Natia. She'd met my gluttony with wide-eyed innocence and questions. Now she observed quietly with the eye of a cat in the bushes, ready to leap, not unlike the rest of us. We all wore weapons to the table, which in the past would have been forbidden by protocol. Tonight, no one would object. Not even Aunt Cloris. We settled at one end of the table. My mother and aunts, and Pauline's aunt, Lady Adele, came in next. My mother's hair was combed and braided, her dress neatly pressed, and the fire in her that had been buried these past days had surfaced again. I saw it in her eyes, her level shoulders, and high chin. The traitors would not win. I was surprised to see her chatting with Bertie like they were old friends. Orin, Tavish, Jeb, and Caden strolled in together, all of them looking slightly uncomfortable, but my mother greeted them warmly and directed them to seats, and I realized how little all of them really knew everyone else, though we had been here for days. We did need to knit together. A shared meal was for more than nourishing bodies. Servants began filling goblets with ale and wine. Though my mother had promised to keep the fare simple, the sparkling cherry muscat was the exception. "Where's Pauline?" I asked Gwyneth. Lady Adele heard my question and perked up, waiting for an answer too. I knew that after their clash on our first night here, Pauline had avoided her. That was why she stayed at the Abbey with the baby. Today she had moved back. "She had to go to the Abbey to pick something up," Gwyneth answered. Of course, we both knew what that something was. "She'll be here soon," she added, but when Lady Adele looked away, Gwyneth shrugged as if she, too, was uncertain what was delaying Pauline, or if she would come at all. Sven walked in with Captain Azia, and I was surprised to see them both dressed in officers' uniforms. Captain Azia blushed at the fawning of my aunts, and I realized how young he truly was. He and Sven quickly became engaged in conversation with them and Lady Adele. I wondered what had happened to Wraith. I sipped my muscat, and then I heard his footsteps. I knew them as well as my own, the weight, the pace, the slight jingle of his scabbard. He hurried in and paused in the doorway, his hair slightly wind-blown, dressed in his Dalbrecht blues, too. My stomach squeezed against my will. He apologized for being late. He'd been stuck in talks with some of his men. He greeted my mother with additional apologies, then turned to me. He noticed my sling. "The physician said it would help reduce the swelling," I explained. He looked at the sling, back at me, at the sling again, and I knew he was searching for words while others swirled in his head. I knew his tics, his pauses, his breaths. Would his betrothed ever know him as well?
"I'm glad you're following his advice," he finally said. It was only a few spare words, but everyone had paused from their own conversations to watch us. He turned and took his seat at the opposite end of the table. Before the first course was brought in, my mother turned to me. "Leah, would you like to offer a remembrance?" It was more than simple politeness. It was her recognition of the position I now held. Memory tugged behind my sternum, and I stood. An acknowledgement of sacrifice. But there was no plate of bones to lift. I said some of the words only to myself, others for all to hear. "A Christoph unter Kienad. A sacrifice ever remembered. Meunter Ijotande. Never forgotten. Javien hal anziadre. We live another day, and with it may the heavens grant us wisdom. Paviama." Only Caden echoed back Paviama to me. My mother looked at me uncertainly. It was not a traditional prayer.
"Is that a Venden prayer?" she asked.
"Yes," I answered. "And part Moragi's prayer."
"But that last word?" Lady Adele asked. "Pavim?"
"Paviama," I said. My throat tightened unexpectedly.
"It's a Venden word," Rafe answered.
It can mean many things, depending on how it's said. Friendship, forgiveness, love.
You know the language, Your Majesty? My mother asked. He kept his eyes averted from mine.
Not as well as the princess, and of course Caden, but I know enough to get by.
My mother's gaze shifted to Caden and then to me. I saw the worry in her eyes. A Vendan language, a Vendan assassin seated at our table, a Vendan prayer, and Caden's lone response to it. He and I shared far more than just an escape from Venda.
Sven seemed to notice my mother's pause and jumped in, saying how he had learned Vendan after being a prisoner in a mine for 2 years with a fellow named Falgriz. A beast of a man, but he helped keep me alive.
He entertained everyone with a colorful story, and I was grateful to him for drawing the attention away from me. My aunts were spellbound by the daring account of his escape. Tavish rolled his eyes as if he'd heard the story before, many times over. The first course was served, a cheese dumpling. Comfort food. I looked up at my mother, and she smiled. It was what she served whenever I or my brothers weren't feeling well. I was grateful she hadn't gone to great lengths to impress King Jackson. In light of everything that had transpired, a simple meal seemed the most appropriate. When my mother inquired about the Valspri, Sven told her the message had surely arrived at the outpost by now, but we wouldn't hear anything back. He explained it was a one-way message only that we had to keep our hopes in.
"Then we shall keep that hope," Aunt Burnett said, "and be grateful to all of you for providing it."
My mother lifted her glass and offered a toast to Rafe, his soldiers, the Valspri, and even for the colonel who would receive the message and help her sons. A rally of toasts followed, circling the table and offering gratitude to all those present who helped uncover the conspiracy. My chest warmed with many sips of muscat, and a server stepped in to refill my goblet.
"And to you, Caden," my mother said. "I'm so very sorry for how you were betrayed by one of our own, and doubly thankful you are helping us now."
"A Morgi's son returned home," Aunt Cloris said, lifting her glass.
I watched Caden squirm at the assumption that he was no longer Vendan, but he nodded, trying to accept the acknowledgement with grace.
"And to—"
I lifted my glass, trying to divert the attention from him. Heads turned my way as everyone waited to hear who or what I toasted. I looked at Rafe. It was as if he knew what I was going to say before I did. The blue ice of his eyes drilled into mine. We had to get past this. Regroup, move forward. It's what a good soldier does. I swallowed.
"I'd like to offer congratulations to King Jackson on his upcoming marriage. To you and your bride. I wish you a long and very happy life together."
Rafe didn't move, didn't nod, didn't say anything. Sven lifted his glass and elbowed Tavish to do the same, and soon a flurry of good wishes rippled around the table. Rafe threw back the rest of his wine and said a quiet, "Thank you." My throat was suddenly sand, and I realized I didn't truly wish them well at all, and I felt small and petty, and an ache bloomed in my chest. I gulped down my drink, draining my goblet. And then we heard more footsteps. Small, hesitant, the soft tap of slippers on stone. Pauline. Heads turned toward the door expectantly, but then the soft sound mysteriously stopped. Lady Adele's brows pulled down.
"Maybe I..."
Caden pushed back his chair and stood.
"Excuse me," he said.
And with no further explanation, he left the room.
Chapter 77, Caden.
She was sitting on a bench in the shadows of an arched passageway, the baby in her arms, her gaze lost in some distant world. Her long honey locks were neatly tucked into a netted cap, her dress reserved and buttoned, every stitch and line of it conveying propriety. She didn't look up as I approached. I stopped, my knees almost grazing hers. Her gaze remained fixed on her lap. "I was on my way," she said, "and then I realized he doesn't have a name. I can't go in there without a name. You said it yourself. I need to give him a name." I bent down on one knee and lifted her chin to meet my gaze. "Pauline, it doesn't matter what I say or what anyone in there thinks. You choose a name when you're ready." She studied me. Her eyes traveled over every inch of my face, her gaze restless and afraid. "I thought he loved me, Caden. I thought I loved him. I'm afraid of making wrong choices again." She swallowed, and her restless search stopped, her gaze settling into mine. "Even when a choice feels so completely right." I couldn't look away. My breath was suddenly trapped in my chest, and I was afraid of making wrong choices too. All I could see were her lips, her eyes, everywhere. Only Pauline. "Caden," she whispered. My breath finally rattled free. "I guess if a choice feels right, maybe it's best to test it first," I said. "Take it slowly. See if it can become something more, something you can be sure of." She nodded. "That's what I want. Something more." That was what I wanted, too. I stood. "I'll go in first. I'll tell them you'll be along." I returned to the dining room just as the next course was being served, Birdie's fish stew. Leah had risen and walked around the table to kiss her cheek and tell her how many times she had dreamed of every morsel, every scent, every taste that was Birdie's stew. I knew as soon as I caught the scent that, yes, it was better than Enzo's, but then I asked everyone to hold off for just a moment. "I think I saw Pauline coming down the hallway. She should be here any moment." And in only seconds, she walked in. She paused, standing in the arch of the doorway, her cap pulled loose, the blanket drawn back from the baby's head so his blonde wisps showed, and his little fist was free to stretch in the air. "Hello, everyone. I'm sorry I'm late. The baby had to be fed." Silverware clattered somewhere in the room. "The baby?" Lady Adele said. "Yes, Aunt," Pauline answered. She cleared her throat, then lifted her chin. "This is my son. Would you like to see him?" Silence vibrated through the room. Lady Adele's mouth hung open. "How is it possible for you to have a son?" she finally asked. Pauline shrugged. "Oh, I got him in much the usual way." Her aunt looked at me and my white blonde hair, and then back at the baby. I saw the assumption she was making, and I was about to correct her, but then I said nothing. I would leave that to Pauline. The baby broke the silence with a loud wail. "Bring him here," Birdie said, holding her arms out. "I know how to rock that sweet potato, so he..." "No," Lady Adele said. "Let me see the child. Does he have a name?" Pauline crossed the room. "Not yet," she said as she laid the baby in her aunt's arms. "I'm still trying to find the right one." Lady Adele patted, jiggled, and shushed the baby, and he quieted. She looked up at Pauline, her eyes blinking, her hand still patting, and it seemed her mind spinning. "Finding a name isn't so hard," she finally said. "We'll help you." Now go sit. Your stew is getting cold. I'll hold him while you eat.
Chapter 78.
Even through the closed balcony doors, I could hear the laughter in the dining room. It was a good thing. A rare thing. It was momentary, I knew. The worry would close in again, but for a few hours, it was a blessed saving grace from the cares that gripped us. Names for the baby had been bantered around the table. Oren offered up his own name several times, but most of the names were drawn from revered historical lines in Morrigan. When Caden suggested Rhys, saying that a name that had no Morrigy's history to live up to might signify a fresh start, Pauline agreed, and it was settled. The baby was named Rhys. I had waited for at least 5 minutes after Rafe left to excuse myself. I didn't want anyone to think his departure hastened my own, but it had. The room suddenly grew hot, and I needed air. He had never spoken or looked at me again after my toast, which shouldn't have bothered me. There were so many at the table, so many conversations, and we were... nothing. At least nothing more than two leaders working together to find answers. I heard the door open behind me, the conversations from the dining room growing briefly louder, then muffled again as the door clicked shut.
"Mind if I join you?" Sven asked.
I waved to the balcony rail beside me, though I really didn't want any company. "Please do." This wing of the citadel looked out on the forested hills, the same ones Pauline and I had disappeared into months ago. The tops of the trees were a black, jagged edge against the starlit sky. Sven stared out into what was mostly darkness.
"You're not cold out here?" he finally asked.
"What's on your mind, Sven? It's not the goosebumps on my arms."
"I was surprised you offered a toast to the king's betrothal."
I sighed. "There's been awkwardness. You've probably seen it. I thought it might be best just to get it out in the open and behind us." He nodded.
"You're right. It's probably for the best."
Bitterness rose in my throat. I hated things being for the best. They never really were. It was a phrase that sugarcoated the leftover crumbs of our options. But I was surprised at how swiftly the betrothal happened after we parted. Sven looked at me oddly.
"You do understand that he had no choice?"
"Yes, I know, for the stability of his reign." A furrow spread across his brow.
"He turned down plenty of barons offering their daughters for the stability of his reign. But he couldn't turn down the general's offer."
"Then the general's daughter must be very special."
"Without a doubt, she is. She..."
Why was he doing this to me? I turned to leave. "Excuse me, Sven, but I..." He reached out and lightly touched my arm to stop me.
"I figured he didn't tell you everything. You need to hear this, Your Highness. It won't change anything. It can't change anything," he said more gravely. "But maybe it will give you a better understanding of what the king had to do. I don't want you to think him so shallow that as soon as you were out of his sight, he forgot you."
He told me that Rafe had returned to a kingdom in more turmoil than any of them expected. The assembly and cabinet were at one another's throats, commerce was in shambles, and the treasury greatly depleted. Dozens of decisions that had been put off were thrown at Rafe. He worked from sunup to late into the night. Everyone was looking for the young king to restore confidence and offered him 100 opinions on how to do it, and all the while the general was breathing down his neck like a lion ready to pounce, the same general who had challenged him.
"But through it all, I know there wasn't a day he didn't wonder and worry about you, questioning whether he should have let you go or whether he should have gone with you. The first thing he did was have that book of yours translated."
"The one he stole." He grinned.
"Yes. He was hoping you'd made a mistake. That he could stop worrying."
"But he learned otherwise?" He nodded, then looked at me pointedly.
He also discovered the two passages that you failed to mention.
What does any of this have to do with his betrothal, Sven?
He didn't tear out of Dahlbreck only to save your kingdom or his. Those thoughts came later. He was only a young man racing against time, desperate to save someone he still loved, but he knew he had to be clever about it, too. He ordered the general to outfit a special company of soldiers by the next day so he could slip undetected into your kingdom with the very best men at his side. The general agreed on one condition.
My stomach slowly crawled into my throat. A condition? He blackmailed Wraith?
I think the words negotiation and compromise were bandied about. He claimed he only wanted to ensure that Wraith returned home this time.
As stunned as I was, I also felt something lift in me.
Then it's not a real betrothal at all. When he gets back to Dahlbreck, he can...
I'm afraid it is very real, Your Highness.
But
one thing you should know. A betrothal agreement is the same as law in Dahlbreck. Why do you think our kingdom became so enraged when your betrothal to the prince was broken? In our kingdom, it doesn't matter if it's written on paper or offered with a handshake. The word of a man is a promise. And this time, Jackson has given his word to his own people. He has already pushed the limits of their trust by his long absence. A king, in the eyes of his subjects, who cannot be trusted to honor his word, is not a king to be trusted at all. If he broke this promise, he wouldn't have a kingdom to return to.
He could lose his throne? My mind spun with how much Wraith had risked.
Yes, and he cares deeply about his kingdom. They need him,
Sven answered.
It's the kingdom of his fathers and ancestors. It's in his blood to lead.
I understood the weight of promises, and Wraith's strength as a king mattered more to Morrigan now than it ever had. It mattered to me. I stared out at the jagged line of forest, feeling the stinging irony of Wraith's choice. To help me and the kingdom of Morrigan survive, he had been forced to cut out my heart. "Is she kind?" I finally asked.
Sven cleared his throat and shrugged. "She seems agreeable enough."
"Good," I said. "He deserves that much." And I meant it. I left and went to the roof, where it was only me, 1,000 blinking stars, and the beauty of darkness stretched to the ends of the universe, snuffing out the endless games of courts and kingdoms.
They passed through the long valley, and the sentinels of devastation looked down on Morrigan from the towering peaks, whispering that the end of the journey was near. But darkness roared, striking out again, and Morrigan fought for the holy remnant, spilling the blood of darkness, vanquishing it forever. Morrigan, Book of Holy Text, Volume 4. Chapter 79.
I sipped hot chicory out of a tall mug, studying the maps spread across the table in the meeting chamber. I moved them around as if looking at them from a new angle would make me see something I hadn't before.
There. It swirled inside me, a distant voice pushing me to look again and again, but I didn't know what I was searching for.
There. An answer? A warning? I wasn't sure. I'd arrived early because I couldn't sleep. It was still dark when I heard the cries of children. I threw back my quilt and looked out the window, but the cries weren't coming from outside. They hovered in my room and swam behind my eyes. I saw them huddled, afraid, the young Venden soldiers who were on their way. And then I heard the Brezelots, their breath hot and fierce, the steam from their nostrils filling the night air. and finally the whispers of the Komazar crawled beneath my skin like vermin raising my flesh. Fervor, Jezalia, fervor. Are you understanding me at last? There was no going back to sleep after that. I dressed and crept down to the kitchen, where a kettle of hot water always steamed, and while my chicory steeped, I knelt beside the hearth, saying my morning remembrances, thinking of Morrigan crossing the wilderness with no map to guide her, and the courage she must have conjured. I prayed for that same courage. There were at least a dozen maps laid out on the table, ones just of Civica, others of the whole kingdom, and still more of the whole continent. The maps blurred, and a scent streamed through me, fragrant, like crushed grass in a meadow. The tiny hairs raised on my neck. There. A voice as clear as my own. I earnestly rearranged the maps again, this time examining the southern routes, but they had no more answers for me than before. There were dozens of possibilities. We had gone around and around about which route the Komazar would take, though once he spilled into Morrigan, it would make little difference. It wouldn't take 120,000 soldiers long to quash villages along the way and then engulf Civica. Another looming question was when they would get here. How long did we have? Much depended on the route, though the difference between southern and northern routes was still only a matter of days. Lookouts had been sent to provide early warning, but they could not scout every mile of a vast wilderness. The last 2 weeks had taken much of our strategizing outdoors, riding the surrounding countryside, trying to find strategic locations to mount and fortify our defenses. Civica was miserably vulnerable, and the blockades being built on the two main arteries seemed woefully inadequate. During this time, I began training again. As soon as the sling and bandage came off, I tried to regain the strength in my left hand, but the numbness persisted. It was good for holding a shield and little else. I couldn't hit a target from 10 feet. My right hand had to work harder. I tried to hide my frustration as Natia and I trained dozens of women who had come forward to serve in the effort, many of them already skilled with bows and swords. When he saw women among the troops, General Howland's jaw clenched so tight I thought it might crumble into 100 blustering splinters. "Every willing soldier is welcome and needed, General," I told him, stamping out his arguments before they could begin. "A woman will be leading you into battle. Why would you be surprised to see them among the ranks?" He had looked at me, stunned, and I realized it was the first time he had grasped that I would be going into the battle with him. Yes, he was counting the days until my father recovered or my brothers returned, but there were still no signs of either one. The door opened, and I glanced up. Rafe stood there, a steaming mug in his hand, too. I looked back at the maps. "You're early."
"So are you," he said.
I hadn't told him that I knew the circumstances of his betrothal. My toast hadn't entirely eliminated the awkwardness between us. There were times he caught me looking at him, and I would quickly look away. At other times, his gaze lingered on me even when our conversation was finished, and I wondered what he was thinking. But we eased into a rhythm. Friends. Comrades. Like Caden and I were. He walked over to my side of the table and looked at the sprawled papers with me. His arm brushed mine as he pushed a map aside. My skin burned with his touch, burned in a way it shouldn't between friends. It wasn't right, I knew, but I couldn't help what I felt.
"See anything?" he asked.
I saw only that our efforts seemed futile. "No."
"We'll find a way," he said, reading my thoughts.
Caden arrived, and we conferred, as we did each morning before everyone else joined us, about what needed to be addressed that day. The discussion of evacuating towns along likely invasion routes needed to be broached,
but we knew that could stir panic and disrupt supply chains that we desperately needed. We leaned back in our chairs, our boots resting on the table, and hours later, we were in much the same position as we listened to Tavish and Captain Renault wrestle over ways to bring down a Brezalot. They were nasty, charging creatures, and perfect for the delivery of the Komazar's most destructive weapon. Both men had seen them killed with spears, but that would require too close a proximity to the exploding animals. They agreed a siege crossbow would work, but without knowing exactly where the enormous horses would charge from, we would need dozens of the weapons. Morgan had four that hadn't been used in years. Heavy siege weapons weren't useful for most battles that occurred in remote field locations. Killing a man required only a sword or arrow. The order went out for more siege crossbows to be built. There was a knock at the door, and a sentry announced that servers were here with the midday meal. Maps were moved to a side table, and platters were brought in. As we ate, talk turned back to the training of soldiers, and my thoughts returned to my brothers. I looked at Rafe across the table from me. I wasn't sure I had ever thanked him for requesting an escort home for my brother's squads, and then I selfishly wondered how many soldiers were in a Dalbrech battalion. In Morgan, a battalion consisted of 400 soldiers. Once here, would his men stay and help us? I knew the same thought had simmered in Caden's mind, and then between bites of his brisket and bread, the field marshal suddenly spoke aloud the question that we all had on our minds. Would Dalbrech send more troops to help Morrigan? The room fell silent. The question had already been asked. Rafe had maintained since his arrival in Civica that he and his men were there only to help root out traitors, stabilize our kingdom, and help us prepare our forces for a possible invasion. The field marshal had put Rafe in an awkward position by asking again. Dalbrech was in jeopardy, too. Rafe had his own borders to think about, not to mention his own troubled reign. He had already risked much just in coming here. I saw Sven's focus sharpen, waiting to see what he would say. Rafe studied me, weighing his answer carefully, then looked back at the field marshal.
When I sent the message to Fontaine, I also made a request for troops.
Expressions around the table brightened.
How many? Marquez asked. All of them.
Sven leaned back in his chair and sighed.
It's our largest outpost. That's 6,000 soldiers.
A few hushed seconds passed.
Well, that's...
The field marshal's brows were slivered moons above his wide eyes.
Remarkable, Howland finished.
And very much welcomed, Marquez added.
I made a similar request to Marabella, Rafe added. They'll pick up troops at two more outposts along the way. That's another 2,000. I'm certain they'll all come, as long as the Valspri got there without incident. I can't make a promise about the rest.
I wasn't sure we heard him right. The rest? I said, as stunned as everyone else. Sven stood, his hands pressed against the table.
The rest?
The 32,000 troops still in Dalbrech that I'm pulling from our borders. As I said, I can't promise they'll come. The transition of power has had some obstacles. The general I had to request the troops from is also the one who recently challenged me. He might use this request as a way to resume his campaign for the throne. It's unlikely, though.
Rafe looked at me, hesitating.
Because you're betrothed to his daughter, I finished.
Rafe nodded.
Unlikely?
Sven stared at Rafe in disbelief, his eyes blazing, then turned and walked out of the room, slamming the door behind him. Rafe nodded at Tavish to go after him, and Tavish left, too. There was a quiet lull, officers staring at the door, Sven's anger still hovering in the air. And then the field marshal looked back at Rafe. I saw the doubt in his eyes. Helping a princess with a rebellion to expose traitors was one thing, but a king abandoning his own borders was an act of insanity.
Why in the gods' names would you do that? It will leave your own borders vulnerable.
Rafe's composure didn't falter. I have no doubt the Komazar will attack Dalbrek, but not before he attacks Morrigan. He's coming here first.
So the princess has said, but how can you be certain that
it's a calculated risk? Not bringing my troops here is the greater risk. It could spell our own destruction. From a strategic standpoint, you have the ports and resources to take over every other Western kingdom. Once the Komazar has Morrigan, he's unstoppable.
He paused, his eyes briefly searching mine.
But it's far more that makes me certain. Someone once asked me if I ever felt something deep in my gut.
He looked back at the field marshal, then skimmed the walls around us and the ancient mural that told the story of the girl Morrigan, his gaze rising to the ceiling, the stones, and it seemed, the mortar of the centuries that held it all together.
This is the jewel the Komazar hungers for. Morrigan is the oldest kingdom, the one that gave birth to all the others. It has never fallen. It's a symbol of greatness, but more than that, it's the kingdom the gods ordained from the beginning. To the Komazar, conquering Morrigan is the same as conquering the gods. I saw that desire in his eyes when I was in Venda, and he will settle for nothing less.
We sat there for long, stunned seconds, and I knew Rafe had perceived the Komazar's ambitions with amazing clarity. "Thank you, King Jackson," I finally said. "However many may come, each soldier will make us stronger, and for each one we will be in your debt." But I was thanking him for more than his troops. He was in this as knee-deep as Caden and I were now. It was all or nothing. A renewed exuberance erupted in the room, the generals and officers adding their thanks to mine, but Caden, Rafe, and I exchanged a knowing look. If all the troops Rafe requested came, our combined forces would number 70,000. We were still outnumbered almost 2-1 by an army that would descend upon us with more deadly weapons. Rafe tempered their response with a reminder that this was only a bandage on a gaping wound. What we needed was a needle and thread to stitch it shut.
"But it's a damn good bandage," the field marshal said.
Discussions resumed. With the added forces in mind, the generals began talking of more defensive blockades on key Morrigan arteries. A needle and thread. I stared at Caden. His mouth was moving, but I couldn't hear the words. The room grew hazy. The deliberations became a distant rumble, even as other sounds rose to the forefront. A creak. A crunch. A wheel on stone. I remembered hearing the clang of the bridge. It came too soon, before first thaw. The sounds in my head grew louder, the room dimmer. The hiss of steam, a keening howl, hurried footsteps, fright thick as night. "Fervor, Jezalia, fervor," a hot whisper in my ear. And then another voice, soft and quiet, as thin as a flutter of wind. "There."
"Leah?" Caden said, touching my arm. I jumped, the haze vanishing. Everyone stared at me, but all I could think was, "Pachigos." My chair squealed back behind me, and I raced to the side table where the piles of maps lay. "Move the food!" I yelled as I carried the armful of maps to the table and spread them out.
"What the devil? Did you see something?
Someone tell me what she's doing."
I shuffled through the maps until I found the one I wanted.
"There." "A northern route," I said. "This is the way he's coming." A wave of arguments rose.
"We already discounted a northern route. He could get caught in a late snowfall."
"Farther north," I said. "By way of Infernatare. It's the perfect route. It's flat, and winter never reaches there."
By now, both Caden and Rafe were looking over my shoulder at the map, too.
Caden stepped back and shook his head. No, Leah, not there. He would never come that way. You know the clans, even Grizz and Finch. Too many in his army fear the superstitions of the wastelands.
I leveled my gaze at Caden. That's the point. He is using that fear.
He looked at me, still not understanding.
Fervor, Caden. He no longer has me. He'll create his own. A different kind of fervor to push them forward.
The dawning rolled through his eyes, and then the worry. How much sooner would they reach here than we thought?
I've heard them, I said. The cries of the young soldiers, the howls of the Pachigos. The Komazar uses their fear to rally them. And what better way than the wastelands of Infernatare to move his army swiftly across the continent?
I looked back at the map, eyeing an expanse between Infernatare and Morrigan. More words sounded in my head. Rafe's words, chiding me as my sword blocked his.
Attack! Don't wait for me to wear you down.
What is this? I asked, pointing to what looked like a V-shaped line of peaks at the end of Infernatare. Captain Renault stepped closer to see what I pointed at.
Sentinel Valley. Sometimes it's called Last Valley.
He explained it was believed to be the last valley Morrigan led the remnant through before they reached their new beginning. He had traveled through it a few times in convoys headed to Kandora.
Keep on the move. Let surprise be your ally.
Why is it called Sentinel Valley? I asked.
Ruins, he answered. They sit atop the high hills that hem in the valley as if they're watching you. Light can play tricks there. It's an eerie trail, and when the wind whistles through the ruins, soldiers say it is the ancients calling to one another.
I asked him specifics about the terrain, the height of the peaks, the length of the valley, and the multiple canyons that lay beyond the peaks.
Advance! The sword is a killing weapon, not a defensive one. If you're using it to defend, you're missing a chance to kill.
Renault said it was 10 miles of valley that narrowed to a point less than 50 yards wide. I already envisioned the Komazar's front lines. They would be the youngest, whom he would consider the most disposable of his army.
Venda has no children.
He would throw it in my face, expecting it to undo me as it had that day on the terrace. Undo every Morrigese soldier who was reluctant to lift their sword against a child.
We're wasting our time trying to defend Civica. We need to advance.
Advance? Where?
General Howland grumbled.
What are you...
This is our needle and thread. Containment. We funnel his army and then hit him with surprise attacks from the side. We take on the strongest while we are still strong. It might be our only chance.
I pointed to the small V on the map.
There. This is where we'll meet the Komazar's army. We move all our troops to Sentinel Valley.
The arguments exploded. Howland, Marquez, and Perry came at me with everything they had, thinking I was as crazy to move our entire forces to one very distant location on what they called a hunch. Rafe and Caden studied the maps, quietly conferring. Then both looked at me and nodded. The Field Marshal and Renault seemed caught between it all.
"Do you know how long it would take to move 30,000 troops that far?"
Howland bellowed, shaking his finger at me.
"So you're saying that a barbarian leader can move a staggering army of 120,000 troops across the entire continent, and we can't manage to move our smaller forces to a location just outside our borders? Perhaps we should just give up now, General?"
"But there's no proof he's coming from the north at all,"
Marquez shouted. Perry threw his hands up in the air.
"Leave Civica unprotected? You can't!
This point," I said sharply, "is not under advisement. We begin laying out new strategies in the morning. We head out by the end of the week. You're free to leave now to prepare our troops to move."
Howland stepped toward me, his fists rigid at his sides.
"This is not going to happen," he yelled. I'll take it up with the Queen. You are not...
Rafe and Caden both tensed, looking as if they were ready to send him for another swim in the fountain, by way of the window. But then pounding shook the door to the chamber. It flew open, and the timekeeper burst into the room, pushing past the sentry, his eyes bulging and his face shining with sweat. Pauline and Gwyneth rushed in on his heels.
"What is it?" I asked, my heart jumping to my throat.
"It's the King,"
he said, between labored breaths.
"He's awake, and he wants to see all of you in his chamber, immediately."
Chapter 80
General Howland was the first out the door, as if this were a gift delivered into his hands by the gods themselves. My father is awake. It is a gift, I thought, but maybe not a timely one. Rafe and Caden both balked, wondering if their presence was actually requested. Pauline assured them it was. Neither seemed eager to meet my father. We walked briskly through the hallways, the timekeeper and General Howland leading the way. Pauline and Gwyneth told us the Queen was at his side, and the King had already been informed of everything that had transpired.
"You mean that little thing called a rebellion?" Rafe said, and rubbed his neck like it was headed for a noose.
"Not amusing," I said. Our footsteps echoed in the hallway, sounding like a small stampede of nervous goats. It felt like we would never get there, but then, before I was ready, the door to his outer chamber opened, and we were ushered in by my Aunt Cloris. The rest of the cabinet members, including the royal scholar, were already there.
"Go on in," she said. "He's waiting."
My pulse pounded, and we filtered into his room. He sat in his bed, propped up with pillows. His face was lined and gaunt and looking far older than his years, but his eyes were bright. My mother's chair was beside the bed, and their hands were laced together in uncharacteristic familiarity. His eyes landed on me first, lingering for a long scrutinizing moment before he finally moved on, eyeing the others present.
"I understand you were having a meeting," he said. "And I wasn't invited?"
"Only because you were indisposed, Your Majesty," I answered. His brows pulled together.
"I guess a daily dose of poison didn't quite agree with me."
"Your Maj—"
my father scowled.
"I'll get to you, Howland. Wait your turn."
The general nodded.
"Which of you is the King of Dalbrek?"
"That would be me, Your Majesty,"
Rafe answered. My father lifted his hand with much effort and waved Rafe closer with a crooked finger.
"You here to take over my kingdom?"
"No, sir, only to assist."
It was clear my father was still very weak, and I knew Rafe measured his words carefully. I also detected a certain nervousness in his response, and Rafe was never nervous. It made my breath catch.
"Come closer. Let me get a better look at you."
Rafe stepped forward and fell to one knee at his bedside.
"What are you on your knee for?" my father growled. "One king doesn't bow to another. Your steward didn't teach you that?"
His eyes danced, and he briefly glanced at me before turning back to Rafe.
"Unless you're on bended knee for another reason? If that's the case, you're facing the wrong person."
Oh, dear gods. He was toying with Rafe. This was not my father. Had the poison addled his brain?
"No other reason," Rafe said, and quickly returned to his feet.
My father waved Rafe back.
"And you must be the assassin,"
he said to Caden. He waved Caden forward in similar fashion. Caden did not fall to a knee, but I knew he wouldn't. He would never have bowed to royalty, even if it cost him his life. My father didn't seem to notice the snub, and studied Caden. He swallowed, and I saw a glimmer of regret in his expression. as if he saw the resemblance between Caden and the vice-regent.
I knew about you. Your father told me your mother took you away.
Deception has always been his strength, Caden answered. My father's chest rose in a ragged breath.
And yours, too, I understand.
I glanced at Pauline. She had been in on the briefing, but had she told him about Terevin?
You here to kill anyone, boy?
A faint grin lit Caden's eyes. He was ready to play this game with my father.
Only on your daughter's orders. She order you to kill me?
Caden shrugged. Not yet. My father's eyes sparked, the game invigorating him, bringing him back to life. His gaze turned to me. He scowled again.
You disobeyed my orders, Arabella. And I understand you bartered off the wedding cloak jewels that have been in our family for generations. You must be punished.
Generals Howland and Perry shifted happily on their feet.
Your Majesty, Rafe intervened. If I may—
No, you may not, my father snapped. This is still my kingdom, not yours. Step back, King Jackson.
I nodded to Rafe, trying to assure him. Wait. My father settled back against his pillows.
And your punishment is that you will continue to reign in my stead, enduring all the endless absurd peckings of the office, until I am fully recovered. Do you accept your punishment, Arabella?
My throat was thick, aching. I stepped forward. Yes, Your Majesty, I do. I swallowed, and then added, On one condition. Surprised mumbles erupted. Even in his weak state, my father managed to roll his eyes.
A condition on your punishment. You haven't changed, Arabella.
Oh, yes, Father. I most definitely have.
The condition?
You will support me in whatever I decide, because there are many hard decisions that still lie ahead, and some of them will not be popular with everyone.
Unpopular? Like the coup?
Yes, that unpopular.
Then I approve your condition.
He looked past me at everyone else.
I am confident that Arabella will meet her punishment, to my full satisfaction. Does anyone object?
No one spoke, though I knew words silently raged on some tongues.
Good, my father said. Now everyone out. I want to speak to my daughter. Alone.
As soon as the room was emptied and I turned back to him, I saw that his performance had drained him. He sank deeper into the pillows, weaker than before. His eyes glistened.
I am sorry, Arabella.
I curled up on the bed beside him, nestling my head on his chest, and he managed to put his arm around my shoulder and pat my arm. He apologized for many things, not the least of which was becoming so weary of his position that he allowed corruption to creep in right beneath his nose.
I failed as a father and as a king.
We all make mistakes, Father. Hopefully, we learn from them and move forward.
How did you end up with an assassin and newly crowned king as your confidants?
The gods have a wicked sense of humor.
And you trust them?
I smiled, thinking of all the deceptions and betrayals that had passed between us. With my life, I answered.
Is there anything more to this union?
Far more, I thought. Maybe more than any of us really understood. Together they will attack, like blinding stars thrown from the heavens. Yes, I answered. They not only give me hope, they are Venda's hope, too.
I meant,
I know what you meant, Father. There is nothing more between us.
And what is this unpopular decision?
I told him.